It's Illume Group's Andrea Lay, Packed View's Melissa Burdick, the Wizard of Wooden Hill Shri, and I'm PVSB from Flywheel, a division of Omnicom. Before we get to the CPG Guys episode you've downloaded, it's the week of April 22nd, and of course it's time for the Fresh Four. Four curated news stories from the past week. We found them boundlessly intriguing. We hope you do too. Brought to you through our partnership with RetailWit, your one-stop shop for retail industry intelligence and news. RetailWit.com. It's retail right now. Leading off, Shri.
Thank you, Peter. And Amazon Live introduces a new shoppable ad-supported channel to Prime Video called Freevee, featuring 24/7 interactive content from celebrities and brands, leveraging its Shop the Show technology to enhance viewer engagement and boost its advertising revenue. At least that's the plan. The channel leverages Amazon's Shop the Show technology to enable viewers to easily purchase content seen on the TV screen via a mobile device. The CPG guys and I are excited to try this out, and we will report back how it performs back here in one of our blogs on the CPG guys. So I look forward to that. Over to you, Peter, for what's going on with Walmart Marketplace.
Thanks, Shri. Walmart Marketplace opens Omni service to auto sellers. Walmart is enabling customers to order eligible tires from Walmart sellers and have them shipped to a local Walmart store for easy installation at their auto care centers. Walmart sellers have added 12,000 unique items, including specialty tires, to provide nearly 40,000 marketplace offers that are installation eligible at 2,300 auto care centers around the country. The expanded tire selection complements Walmart's existing auto services that include accessories and battery services, while giving sellers more access to Walmart's omnichannel customer base. Over to you, Andrea.
Hello, Fresh Four listeners. Amazon begins offering Dash Carts to other grocers. Amazon has begun offering its Dash Carts to third-party grocers, expanding the checkout technology beyond Amazon grocery banners and Whole Foods market stores, according to a blog post from the company. Amazon introduces Dash Carts to non-Amazon grocery stores, starting with select locations in the Kansas City area. This rollout comes shortly after Amazon ceased its Just Walk Out technology in Amazon Fresh and Whole Foods. Customers using Dash Carts tend to spend 10% more, with over 80% of the transactions from repeat users, highlighting the cart's convenience and efficiency. Over to you, Melissa.
So Heinz has launched a new limited edition barbecue sauce. Heinz and Barbie lovers in Europe are in luck. A limited edition pink vegan mayo with barbecue sauce was launched to celebrate Barbie's 65th anniversary. Mattel and Heinz have unveiled the new Heinz Classic barbecue sauce. It will be available in the UK and Spain initially, and may be available elsewhere in the future. Additionally, there's 5,000 bottles of the new sauce available to purchase online, but they can only be shipped to the UK and Ireland. So for those of you in the US who are curious, you can do what I do and go to TikTok and search pink barbecue sauce, and you will find it.
Thank you, Melissa. That's it for the Fresh Four. Now on to the CPG Guys episode that you've downloaded. Welcome to another episode of the CPG Guys podcast. Our hosts, Shri Rajagopalan, Peter V.S. Bond, and Brian Gildenberg, explore how brands and retailers engage consumers in an increasingly digitally driven world. And now, here are the CPG Guys. Hey everyone, this is PVSB with the CPG Guys. I am joined by my fellow CPG guy, Brian Gildenberg, aka the founder and CEO of Confluencer Commerce. We are coming to you live from Barcelona.
Buenos dias.
Thank you for speaking Spanish, because I wasn't going to be able to help you there. Francais, absolument. Oh, Espanol, oui, oui. No.
It's buenas tardes, I believe, right now, given the time of day.
It actually is. Yeah, and we're here attending the Shop Talk Europe conference.
We are.
So what we thought we'd do today is just give you some thoughts on everything that we've been hearing, just a recap of the event. We're not completely done yet, but I think we've heard a lot of the meat of the conversation.
Yeah, I feel like
there's some themes that have surfaced we thought we'd share and just kind of noodle through them. And as always, make sure to follow us on cpgguys.com and follow us on LinkedIn. Make sure you've entered in CPG Guys in the search box if you're not already following us. And when you get to our page, click the blue follow button. That way you'll be privy to all of the content that we are producing. I should also say we were fortunate enough to run into many of the co-hosts of our sister podcast.
We saw
Daniel Torres-Dwyer and Ephraim Rosario, a.k.a. the FMCG guys.
Yes.
And, of course, Jennifer Silverberg was here as well. She's Indeed. Host of CBG Scoop with our dear friend Risa Crandall. And it's like most of these trade shows, Brian, it's a real reunion. I'll also, before I forget to mention, we're so proud to be allied with a network of executive women, formerly now known as Next Up. In fact, Brian had the great honor and distinction of interviewing Lisa Baird, the new CEO of Next Up. That'll be airing probably shortly after this episode does. Mm-hmm. But we're so proud to be allied with an organization that is about advancing all women in business and helping to dismantle gender bias in the workplace. So with that, I'll say to Brian, let's get ready to recap.
Let's get ready to recap.
Let's get ready to recap. I avoided.
You used to avoid the voice because then we would owe Michael Buffet. Like,
I know. We don't have to pay money. So. All right. So what we want to talk about are some of the themes that we all heard about. People talking on stage, people talking in conversations and meetups and everything.
Yes.
I think the first thing to do is we have to take the Wheel of Fortune approach, right, Brian?
Which Absolutely.
Is, you know, the final wheel competition, they immediately give you R-S-T-L-N-E.
Yes.
So, of course, everybody here up on stage had to mention ChatGPT and generative AI. So let's get that out of the way. But there were some actually interesting examples, I thought. Right out of the gate, Neil Arora, who's the global head of e-commerce at Nestle, showed us some very practical examples about how he's been using generative AI around search terms and, frankly, around some of the content he's creating. So there's absolutely some value there, but that's kind of we can talk for hours about that.
I also thought there was some interesting back and forth in one of the sessions I sat through between Mondelez and Carrefour as they were going back and forth about, you know, who's ChatGPT is going to, because the nice person from Carrefour was saying, well, with all due respect to you bringing us your ChatGPT, we're going to have our own ChatGPT, and we're going to. So I do think there's going to be a lot of back.
Is it going to be more erudite, or how's that going to work?
It's going to be ChatGPT. No, I think it'll. It's going to be fascinating to see in the same way as we all start to understand how generative AI vocabulary sort of codifies and supplements or replaces search in some ways from a keywords point of view, how that kind of layers in and how we think about who owns that work. Like, because in the end, obviously ChatGPT is one algorithm, so the only differentiation isn't the answer, it's the question. And the notion of having to get the better questions to drive better outcomes from ChatGPT.
I thought that's a great point. I heard a lot of people saying the input is critically important, so you get a most relevant output to what you want. If you just ask a very broad question, you're going to get back a whole bunch of answers that are to some degree boiling the ocean and not as refined as what you are really looking for.
Yeah, and I think people are going to have to really understand that'll be one of the evolving skill sets, but questioner is going to be a big skill set for the next three or four years.
My big thought around this whole thing is we're on the ChatGPT, so we might as well just beat it to death.
Oh, let's do it.
Let's just do it.
Why don't we ask ChatGPT what it thinks of itself?
Because fundamentally, it does require more, if you want to get a very refined answer, it will require a more sophisticated question. We've spent the better part of the last 20 years indoctrinating shoppers on how to do one-each searches on sites like Amazon.
Right.
And they throw in a brand name or they throw in the name of a product. But how are we going to adjust and educate and train consumers to a world where they can literally say, I've got a party for 20 coming, what should I get? And the retailer plops back an entire plan of products that they would need, that they eat, that they serve with, that they entertain with.
Yeah.
That's going to be another step function in consumers' ability to really embrace all the capabilities. The capabilities are going to be there. Mm-hmm. The question is, are the consumers ready to really understand how to use them without an operating manual?
Right. Well, and I think that's true. And oddly enough, and this just occurred to me now. So
that's okay. Let's riff with it.
Yeah. So, because I've used for years.
We give deep thought to everything talk about here. It is structured out.
But no, it dates back to a model that I've used over the years to take a look at content and just basically saying that the war of the future isn't between digital and physical. Mm-hmm. The war of the future is between vertically organized content and horizontally organized content. Vertically organized content is every search ever, because it's hierarchical,
right?
And every physical store with signs that point out what's in what aisle, mm-hmm. right? Category, subcategory, subcategory, item, vertical. Yep. There's a whole ecosystem of horizontal content in the world.
Yep.
Best example of that is Pinterest from a content point of view. Best example of that is TJ Maxx from a retailer point of view. TJ Maxx might as well not have aisle signs. Nobody cares.
Nobody cares. They're just wandering around looking to see. They're in discovery mode.
Yeah, they're in discovery mode. And I think what ChatGPT is, it's the horizontal version of a vertical search product.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And I think it's going to be fascinating that when you think about what you'll be able to learn, it might be more interesting to look at how people use something like Pinterest to understand how ChatGPT can be helpful than to look at something like Google. So I'm intrigued by this as an idea, and I'm always intrigued by anything that sort of points out the inherent value of Pinterest, even though monetization-wise, it always struggles because it sits in what's traditionally known as a weird part of the funnel. I think ChatGPT might also do that, except that ChatGPT can also completely co-opt search when it needs to.
Maybe it's in a different funnel, like a beer funnel from college.
That would be superb.
That would be outstanding.
So ChatGPT keg stands coming next.
So we actually did give some credible thought to ChatGPT in this conversation.
See, look it up.
Check.
Yes. We keep a license.
Then let's move on to
we are the GPT guys.
We are the GPT. By the way, my name is Chad. I'm your new host.
Hi, this is Chad.
I still get messages from people going, oh, that was a good.
I still think the messages you got, though, I will really miss Peter on the podcast for hysterical. Putting some from people on our own podcast.
What's going on? Why are you giving up the podcast? Look at the date, people. Look at the date. All right. So then we got to move on to our favorite topic, which is, of course, retail media.
Okay.
So what, Brian, were your thoughts around how people here are talking about retail media versus how people in the U.S. talk about retail media? What are some of the thoughts that you would glean from what you're hearing?
Well, I think the single biggest difference is anybody that's ever heard me talk about this topic will know what I'm about to say. The Amazon centricity of the United States retail ecosystem translates into the Amazon centricity of the retail media ecosystem.
Everyone's chasing the market leader in terms of capabilities, in terms of structure.
And in terms of what retail media is supposed to do in the United States, it's a very Amazon-centric conversation. Yeah. And that's why you've got Criteo and Citrus ads that are such a big part of the U.S. landscape in terms of, you know, being able to codify biddable search and all the other stuff that goes along with all of that. Mm-hmm. I think here, most of the retail media evolution is being pushed by retailers that are primarily store-based.
Yeah.
With the exception of some of the, and then there are some pure
e-commerce is dominated more by omni retailers that are primarily brick and mortar.
And then there are also some very large pure plays like Zalando that are not Amazon.
No.
Where you don't have another large pure play in America that is not Amazon, really, except for its category specialists like Chewy. And you have a category specialist in pet here as well. So I think that the interesting thing is that I think the nature of the conversation around retail media is very different in terms of how to think about what the planning process looks like mm-hmm. for bringing together store-based activations and retail media activations, because it's sort of coming out of that store-based thing. The other piece in Europe is that for most of the markets in Europe, a very small select group of retailers are an enormous chunk of your business.
Yes.
The markets are structured a little bit more like Canada than the U.S.
Yes.
From a share point of view, those retailers are often different by market. We'll come back to that.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got a few retailers that are basically your only access point. So we were watching Kenan Demirel from Migros in Turkey, who was talking mm-hmm. about retail media in the last bit. Migros is an enormously dominant part of the Turkish retail.
Yeah, they are. It's especially like Loblaws in Canada.
Especially the formal trade in Turkey. They have about the same share of it that Loblaws does.
Yeah.
So the need for brands to use retail media is more imperative in some ways if the retailer is trying to set the terms of the conversation. So I just think it's a very different business planning problem here in some ways. And I think in some ways, particularly in the thinking about how you build an integrated store-based plan versus a digital plan, I think the Europeans might be a little further along than we are in the U.S.
Well, what I think is common with the U.S. relative to retail media is this growing concern. Certainly, it's been present on the brand side. I think I heard from certainly the speaker from John Lewis, it's being heard on the retail side, is that there is a need for common measurement, common offerings. Everything that makes it easier, frankly, I heard them say, we want to be treated as a media opportunity, not as a retailer. But if you're going to do that, then you're going to have to give brands the measurement techniques.
Yes.
So that they can justify shifting their media budgets. Because mm-hmm. until you do that, you're still going to be a trade spend. And that's not where these retailers want to be. They want to dip into the budgets they haven't had access to.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, and whether that is, you know, somebody like, you know, who we referenced before, who's building something like Walmart Connect, which is a almost like a separate business, really. She runs, Migros spun off its retail media business. So it's a mm-hmm. little bit, almost a little bit more actually like kind of like 84.51, where it's sort of its own thing. You've got that piece as they try to reach into these new and different budgets and insist that they plan a little bit differently. And I thought that was interesting where they were talking about like delineating very specifically what channels in store are media channels mm-hmm. versus what channels in store are trading channels. And again, because retail media here being pushed by the in-store retailers, you've got a probably clearer thinking around that, to be honest, that I saw here than I've seen out of the U.S. retailers.
It was interesting. I was having a little bit, as this was going on, I was having a little bit of a side conversation with our dear friend, Laura Hyland from from BIC. And we were talking about this.
Who will be on our podcast someday.
Who will be on our, but look, Laura, you're coming on the podcast.
I've explained the story.
Yeah, she's coming on the podcast.
She has to come on the podcast.
She wants to be on the podcast.
She really does.
She does. Yeah. She loves us. Who doesn't? Who doesn't love us?
She loves us.
We're adorable.
We really are.
We're like cherubic.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyhow, did I say that right? Anyhow, maybe.
Who knows?
We're a bunch of cherubs. We're like in the Sistine Chapel. We're up there.
Please.
You imagine our faces on the top of the Sistine Chapel. Okay.
Yeah,
we're digressing.
Yeah, we have.
Sorry.
The less I think about you in a toga picture on the top of the Sistine Chapel after you're going to be.
So the question is, you know, if the bill is coming from the retailer, by definition, for a lot of manufacturers, doesn't the retail media have to be paid out of trade? And she brought up a really great example. She goes, well, what about Amazon Web Services?
Yeah.
Are they a retail? If they're a retailer and the bill is coming for us to run our cloud computing off of Amazon Web Services, do we have to pay that out of our trade as well?
Yeah. I mean, and even something even a little bit simpler, like Thursday night, like putting an ad on Thursday Night Football on Amazon.
Right.
It's like, that's an obvious media spend, right?
Yes.
The fact that it's owned by Amazon doesn't make it a retail media. It makes it
a
TV property owned by a business that has a retail business.
So any companies that still have hard and fast rules about if a bill comes from a retailer, if they haven't already addressed it, they're going to have to pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk. I'm going to make a mention of something that we were talking about last year, which I saw appear this year, which was there were presentations on both the metaverse and NFTs. I heard our friend Ekta Chopra from Elf Beauty talk about how they've been investing in some tests around NFTs and how that can drive value for some of their most loyal customers and how some other brands have done that. Yeah. I'm also really interested in, we had a great presentation by our dear friend Christina Marinucci from Mondelez.
Yeah.
And she was talking about the
not
metaverse.
Not only wants to be on the podcast, but has been on the podcast.
Oh, God, she's been on so many times. I know. It's so shameless.
The Marinucci cast is what we're going to read.
It's funny. When I put all of my meetups in here and all my other meetings, and I would list the full name of the person and the company they're with and what I wanted to talk about. For my meeting with her, it just said Marinucci. That's all it needs to say. Christina always has my attention. Oh, yeah. But anyhow, so Christina started off her presentation with a survey to ask people, the promise of the metaverse, flash in the pan, has been realized, may still show some promise. It's real and it's going to have value, or I'm already realizing an enormous amount of value. And decidedly, the results at the beginning of the presentation were at the front end of that spectrum. But after she went through and showed a lot of what Mondelez is doing around creating a virtual environment and in partnering and collaborating with retailers on doing this, at the end of it, she gave the same survey and the majority had shifted to, no, this is actually something that has real wheels to it. And it's going to continue to be a focus of interest and investment on the brand side and the retail side. So I was actually really pleased to see that it wasn't just a flash in the pan, that there is still some promise. I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
I think there's two things. One, I do think that the metaverse owes itself and the audience that's supposed to be participating in it, just a clear, I actually didn't see this presentation, but it sounds like you're starting to get to a point where it needs to get to, which is what are the specific things you can do in the metaverse that are actually useful rather than the concept of the metaverse, which, you know, it's just, that's not that wasn't as helpful a conversation. I think there are specific things. I think there are very specific things NFTs can do that can enhance brand value. And I think there's a lot of application for that. That's always made sense.
Yep.
I think there's brands that make sense to play with in the metaverse that appeal to that audience in a certain way.
I think there's some high-end brands, like I think of Louis Vuitton, Moet Hennessy. Those guys should be playing in that all day long.
Yeah. And I think that my contention has always been with the metaverse and NFTs is that I believe that over time it will change the economics of being famous. And when you change the economics of being famous, you then change the economics of advertising. That's going to have an enormous impact on how advertising works at some point. It will impact advertising probably before it impacts just about anything else. So those are my thoughts on where I think that goes. But I do think that people working in the metaverse probably somebody like me who's like metaverse curious, but like a typical person of my age and general bearing, who's going to have to make a decision about investing in this, an explanation of what it can do that I can't already do in the regular world. Because I think that today is still where it trips up a lot.
I think the most interesting comment I saw today was there's a video clip talking about the promise of the internet. And it was a video clip from Brian Gumbel and Katie Couric.
Oh, that one. Yeah, that's
a good classic one where she's like, Katie Couric just says, I don't think I like this internet. I'm already too busy. I can't be bothered with that. Okay. That didn't age well.
No.
But we'll just leave it at that. So we talked a lot about things we heard. What didn't you hear, or what markets didn't you hear about since we've been here, which is really fascinating?
You pulled this out. Remind my jet lag brain of what I wanted to say.
I'm giving you the cue.
Yes. No, I think the fascinating thing, and this has been, this is my first trip to Europe from a business point of view since before the pandemic. So this is, so you've got 3.5 years of gap.
Sure.
But when I would come here in the 2010s, the Europeans were always, because a lot of them genuinely have global jobs, whereas in America, when you have a global job, your job is to tell the rest of the world what America is doing. Some of the Europeans generally actually legitimately have global jobs.
If there is anyone from the EU listening to us on this, we're sorry. We don't mean to be arrogant Americans.
No, I'm saying that's the actual.
No, I know.
And I think in this case, you're apologizing for a whole nation, not for us.
Exactly.
Even though you're Canadian. What are you? See, you're apologizing for something you didn't do. You're Canadian.
I'm a Canadian. What do we do? All we do is apologize.
You drink Tim Hortons coffee and you apologize.
We apologize.
Yeah.
Oh, so sorry.
We're drinking Tim Hortons.
You could bump into me at full speed and I would be the one apologize.
Yeah, well, if I bumped into you at full speed, I'd fall down.
Oh, there you go.
So back to this. In the 2010s, late 2010s, the Europeans were always so much more viscerally aware of what was happening in China.
Yeah.
And really talked about it as a possible future roadmap for where European digital commerce and e-commerce and digital advertising is going.
Yeah.
Been here for 2 days. I've heard China talked about for 45 seconds. Like,
I know. Nothing. I've heard nothing. I heard Alibaba mentioned once.
Yes.
And it was as a side comment. It wasn't the primary purpose of what they were talking about. So I agree with you. The fact that the Chinese market right now, with respect to Europe, is it's carved up. They're not as focused on it, and they're looking more westward than they are looking eastward.
I think so. And I also think that, yes, I think that there's a combination of, I do think people have begun to realize that the Chinese e-commerce experiment is a fascinating one, but it is a very hard one to extract learnings from because it is so different. And my fear is, unfortunately, I think China's going to start to take the role that Japan always used to play in international businesses, which is like, we could do this everywhere except Japan. No idea how to do it. No idea. Nothing we do in Japan works anywhere else, and nothing we do anywhere else in the world works in Japan.
Sorry, I had to pull a Shree. That was my homage to Shree.
Ah, Shree.
We'll edit that out.
I think it was fascinating the lack of, and because I think people in Europe are preternaturally not inclined to learn from the US, and also that the market's quite different. I think the Europeans are actually trying to sort this stuff out as a theater of op, like really trying to sort it out within a European context, which is really, really interesting because some of the solutions and thinking I saw here as a result, I think were way better and clearer, I guess, than it might have been otherwise. So
I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to the entire democratization of this event through the introduction of meetups, like similar to what was done in Shop Talk. Mm-hmm. This, of course, this meetup is essentially a double opt-in speed dating opportunity that was enabled through Persona Tech, which is the company that was created by the founder of Shop Talk and Grocery Shop, our dear friend Anil Agarwal, who was one of our very first guests on the podcast. It was great. What I'll say is a couple things. One, because unlike, first of all, Shop Talk here is a much smaller venue than Shop Talk in Las Vegas. And as a result of that, there weren't 1,500 tables. There were a couple of hundred tables and much easier to navigate. It didn't take me 30 minutes to get between being running at full pace, hoping to get to it. But that said, I had some really great meetings with quite a number of people that I wanted to meet with. I met with some brands. I met with some service providers. And I think that it distinctly sets Shop Talk and the Grocery Shop brand apart from every other trade show in the industry. I think they built something that is much more appreciated, and it increases the ROI of this event more than a lot of
it. I think, and I think at this event too, I probably enjoyed the presentations more at this event, and part of that is because I know less about Europe, so it's easier for me to sit and learn a lot, and I'm probably in a situation where I'm more open to learning, to be honest, to make this my problem, not Shop Talk's. Because sometimes if you're in the U.S. and you feel like you kind of know everything, you get a little – I find myself getting a little over my own skis a little bit in terms of my own understanding of things and being a little more critical. Here, because I really haven't been in this environment in a while, it was really good to just sit and shut up for a few days or something.
I would also say that just listening to people speak in your English and European accents makes them sound so much smarter.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So this is true.
There's a little bit of some of that.
It's a fantastic point.
All right. Why don't you talk a little bit? I want to go back to retail media because what are your thoughts on, we've had a couple of episodes recently around in-store retail media and it seems to be on the upswing in the States. What were your thoughts around what you're hearing here?
I thought that was interesting here because of the comments we made earlier about how retail media here has evolved more under the watchful eye of the omnichannel retailers, and it's sort of a more omnichannel proposition to begin with, you would have thought then that would have correlated to a larger number of providers that were enhancing and helping the in-store media component be more effectively measured, more effectively managed from a technology point of view. And apart from our friends at Scala, the European arm of Stratacache, who we'll be hanging out with later tonight. Apart from that, I didn't see a lot of solutions in that space and didn't see a lot of conversation about it, to be honest. Yeah. I think the session on tomorrow, actually, but I didn't, it was less conversation around the tech enablement of retail media in store and the effective measurement of retail media in store than I might've thought otherwise. And I think some of that is because there's always been a pretty blurry line here between trade and retail media. And there's kind of a conventional way of looking at it that I don't know that this ecosystem has embraced some of the technological advances that you would need to do in the U.S. where people haven't been thinking about retail media from an in-store point of view. They've been thinking about, oh, this makes sense. They've been thinking about it digitally in the U.S. So you need digital media in the stores in order to think it through. Like the screens are an essential part of retail media in the States because it's a digital first approach.
Okay.
Here, I think people are just more comfortable with some of the messiness of the analog measurement system and knowing that because they've been doing retail media in store for a while. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I think there's enormous opportunity in this market to improve the technology and the measurement and the effectiveness of in-store retail media. Okay. That seemed like a bit of a miss or a bit of an outage.
Something that that occurred to me as I was going around talking to some brands and talking to today in particular, I heard people saying, big scale brands, we're doing everything 1P. We haven't had a good experience with 3P. I had another person on the brand side say to me today, I'm just trying to find a capable 3P warehouse and distribution partner. And I didn't see a lot of companies on the floor that are offering those solutions here. So I wonder if the marketplace model is to some degree challenged here by the fact that there aren't a plethora of 3P partners now in the U.S. The biggest one, Packable, formerly PharmaPax, had an exit event, we'll call it that. not a sell-off, they just exited. Yes. But But yeah. I don't know that there are that many here. And I think that may well be still a significant problem for some of these big brands, that they're really focused on the brands that they can sell 1P and that they can ship to primarily Amazon.
I have a hypothesis about that, which may or may not be right, but it's because logistics and distribution are so much more expensive in Europe than they are in the States.
Yeah.
Everything's more expensive. Petrol's more expensive. Labor's more expensive.
Yeah.
Land's more expensive. There's a certain amount of scale, I think, you need to be able to run that business efficiently. And I don't know that those operators are as adept at developing that sort of skill set or capability as they might be otherwise. So that'll be my hypothesis. I just think it's very hard to build an underscaled logistics business in Europe just because it's just economically almost impossible to do so. So I think starting up in the logistics world is difficult. That would be my guess.
I think we're going to have to refer this over to the FMCG guys to do a little deeper dive.
I would certainly say we are treading all over Daniel and FMCG.
Yeah, we're going to step away and say, guys, this is for you. And they've got a big...
They're going to get Avon Barksdale angry that we're
you know, I heard
corner.
That they were a little bit jealous that the CPG guys went from 2 to 3 recently.
Yes,
bringing you into the franchise. I hear there may be things brewing.
Yes,
with the FMCG guys that they're going to try and take it a step further.
Yes, they might. We may even have a gender reveal party at some point.
We're gonna blow it. We're not going to give up two way, but it's big. It's really big news. As Sullivan said, it's really big.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about sustainability. What did you hear? I heard actually quite a number of brands talking about sustainability as a go-to-market strategy and consumer engagement. What are you hearing?
Well, same thing, and I think that's consistent with the Europe that I've known for years. Mm-hmm. Sustainability is always a bigger part of the conversation here than it is in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There are real meaningful business objectives tied to it. There are certain countries within Europe, notably Germany, mm-hmm. where it is an enormously big deal in terms of how you go to market. Obviously, a lot of the regulations here are quite different. There's rules and tariffs on like virgin plastic here that are very different than they are in the States. Mm-hmm. So recycling, the European Union has, I think, depending on your point of view around what governments do, has either done a heavy-handed or an excellent, depending on your perspective, job of creating an incentive system that almost pushes you into a more sustainable future.
Okay.
But everybody kind of gets that here. And as a result, the conversations that brands have with retailers and retailers have with brands around sustainability, they're real, they're substantive, they're tied to performance objectives, and they're led by super smart people who are really committed to it. So I always find that really inspirational here as a part of the market space, because people are really good at understanding also how to tell that story to some degree to consumers as well.
This is not something that they staff down to a manager level person. They're putting C-level people of incredible caliber who've had great operational experience in the past to bear on solving these problems.
No, I mean, I saw the president of Diageo Europe this morning talking, probably spent a third of a presentation talking about sustainability and purpose and brands.
Brilliant.
The chief customer officer of Danone yesterday, who was amazing, did a terrific job of really, again, you know, the commercials, and then really talking about how, as a business, Danone really thinks about trying to, what did she put this? A great quote. She goes, there's something like sustainability without growth is unviable, and growth without sustainability is unsustainable, right? Or something along those lines.
Yep.
It's just a really good way to put it. So if I'll find my notebook as we're talking, because it's a great quote. So.
Well, that's good. So then while you're looking for that, I'm going to make mention of the fact that one thing I did notice here, even more so that as a proportion of the attendees, certainly compared to other trade shows, but even compared to Shop Talk in the U.S., the brands were here, and they were here in force. They brought large squadrons of people from big CPG companies to spend some time at this event.
Yeah.
I saw large groups from Coca-Cola, from Mondelez, from
Diageo.
Colgate, Diageo, our dear friend Ephraim being one of those.
Of course, yes.
They were here in force, and they were ready to learn and talk. Nestle had a lot of people.
Shout out to my old colleague Alvaro.
There we go. But I was really pleased to see so many brands here, because I think that makes it a much more engaging and meaningful experience, particularly for service providers, because they're obviously investing in coming to this and wanting to have conversations to talk about how their capabilities can help accelerate business for these suppliers, and have the suppliers, the manufacturers, is very important. I think kudos to the team, Sophie Waro and the team at Shop Talk for getting the brands here.
Yes, yes. And I think one of the brands here was Danone. And yeah. their chief customer, this is a great quote here. Sustainability without growth has no impact. Growth without sustainability has no future.
Ooh, I like that.
That was awesome.
We should just take that for ourselves.
Yeah.
Nobody heard that. No, I'm just kidding.
That was really good.
All right. Lastly, talk to me about data, because data seems to underpin a lot. What are some of the things you heard about the importance of data in operational excellence and growth?
Well, I think it's fascinating, obviously, because Europe has a sort of an interesting and complex history and relationship with data. Clearly, through the, as many of you who are working in the data space, you know, GDPR is genuinely a four-letter word in terms of the regulations around data reuse and data, like even emailing a spreadsheet with somebody's name in it here is a fraught with complexity and difficulty. Yep. So you have a bunch of regulations and rules that to some degree make it harder to navigate, like everything in Europe. It's regulated to a degree which would be unfamiliar and uncomfortable to an American. Mm-hmm. But once the regulations are in place, people kind of get used to them and build workarounds for it and figure it out. The biggest thing I thought that was most interesting was some of the conversations around pan-European data. Notably Amazon, who talked a lot about sort of their pan-European approach. The gentleman who runs consumables for Amazon in Europe talked about some of the work that they're doing about trying to centralize some of the work that they do across categories in Europe, because a lot of it's the same. And then Carrefour talked a lot about their data lake, their pan-European data lake. And they basically said, look, we've got 3 billion transaction lives or something in there. We've got the largest data lake in Europe. And the idea of looking at Europe as Europe, and not as just one country, mm-hmm. I think is a reflection to some degree of the importance of retail media versus just commerce. Because I think historically what you've seen is that at a commerce level, that's a P&L business. That's managed market by market. The more you start to drift into media, the more you start to drift into marketing, which is typically run by a brand at a regional, multinational, continental, or even global level. Mm-hmm. So I think this will be a very interesting back and forth over the next couple of years as retail media becomes a bigger part of the equation. The need for the retailers here to present people with more of a pan-European solution from a data perspective to enhance the viability and the attractiveness of their media network.
Brian, thanks for sitting down with me and kind of noodling through
this what's is great,
my
man.
Thoughts. Yeah. Always love doing a decomposition of what we heard. And our next thing on the agenda is to go over to the Skyfall Cocktail Lounge, where our friends at Scala will be hosting
a
little event. And we are the, we're the celebrities, I guess. We're the show and tell. Look, they're the CPG guys. They'll put us up against a wall and we'll do the parade wave.
Yeah, we'll
do photos with people. Yeah, that's great.
There's a dunk tank, I think.
I think that's probably what it is, a bit of a dunk tank. Thank you again, as always. And to our audience, we appreciate you all was listening in. We have fun doing this. We're glad to hear from so many people that they have fun listening. And we look forward to speaking with you on the next episode of the CPG Guys podcast. Goodbye. The content in this podcast episode is provided for general informational purposes only. By listening to our episode, you understand that no information contained in this episode should be construed as advice from CPG Guys LLC or the individual author, hosts, or guests, nor is it intended to be a substitute for research on any subject matter. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by CPG Guys LLC. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. The views expressed by CPG Guys LLC do not represent the views of their employers or the entity they represent. CPG Guys LLC expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, or inability to use this podcast or the information we present in this podcast.